This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Our first guest, Laurie Hulse Anderson, is a New York Times bestselling author of the book Speak. It was a brave book for young adults released in 1999, dealing with the rape of a young girl. After selling 3 million copies worldwide, it essentially opened up the conversation about sexual assault. In speaking to groups of young people around the country now for several decades, Laurie has learned what we talk about and what we don't talk about, what we need to know, both young women and especially young men. She's back now with a book called Shout, Finding Her Courage to Speak Up About Her Own Rape When She Was 13 Years Old. Laurie joins us now by phone. Laurie Hulse Anderson, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Wonderful to have you. Oh, where to start with this? I think the thing that really jumped out at me is what you heard from groups of young people when you would speak to them about your first book, Speak. The questions they had and the things that they didn't understand about sexual assault, especially among young men.
It was a real shocker, let me tell you. When Speak came out 20 years ago, I soon began receiving invitations to speak at high schools all over the country. And I found that boys all over the country, regardless of urban, suburban country, you know, middle of America or on the coasts, they were all very, very confused about what sexual assault was. They all had this misconception that a rapist is always the bad guy who pulls a woman into the alley and has a gun. We have a lot of talking to do with our boys if we're going to raise them up properly.
Yes, and talking from a very early age. And, you know, we talk to our young boys about consent, but I think that, I mean, from what you describe, boys didn't understand about things like the PTSD that can follow a rape. And, wow, it just, you know, this rape just happened for, you know, 2 minutes. And yet this young girl's carrying it with her the rest of her life. And that, it's just amazing what we don't know.
And it's interesting because I've been on book tour for Shout now for a week, and I have talked to so many mothers and a few fathers who've come out to my events who are walking away sort of stunned because they think they've had the conversation. Mm-hmm. But what they've had a conversation about is how to prevent pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases, you know, use a condom or use birth control or whatever. And it never occurred to them that they needed to explain what healthy sexuality and consent is, because they too have been absorbed into this myth that it's always a stranger. If you are under 18 years old, those under 18 victims are assaulted by somebody that they know in 90% of the cases. So we teach a lot about stranger danger. What we have to do a better job is teaching our kids how to communicate, how to give consent in all kinds of situations.
Laurie, I'm curious to go a little bit deeper on this and try to look at maybe some of I'm fearful of calling them the root causes, but there seems to be something in here, and we could go and say there was a time in the past when men respected women, and this would never have happened. Because I'm wondering about that conversation that you're talking about, you know, the one about don't get her pregnant and her sexually transmitted diseases, which I think, you know, my recollection of the conversation that I had was along those lines, and that was a long time ago. So, but I don't think there was this issue, and maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe there has been this this assault or, you know, rape. I know we're calling it rape, and I know that a lot of today's youth would attach violence with the act of rape, and maybe that's the aspect that I'm sort of struggling with is when do we define it as an act of violence? Now we're redefining it as act of non-consent, which doesn't necessarily mean violence. And was it ever different in the past, or has it always been something that we just have not looked closely enough at?
Based on the number of victims that I've spoken to who are in their 70s and their 80s, Tim, I think this has been with us for a very, very long time.
Yeah. Do you have any sense of the numbers? I mean, you say it's been with us for a long time, but I'm just trying to understand kind of the the dimensions of how big it was, even with those 70-year-olds.
Well, in the 1940s, I don't think anybody was doing, I know the Department of Justice certainly wasn't doing any kind of study into sexual violence. Until 1972, men were allowed to rape their wives in the United States federally. And when we use the word, I think that there was an older understanding that rape has to be, has to include a beating, or rape is a case where a woman is fighting back dramatically to try to save herself from this person who is attacking her. There's a couple of things we have to unpack there. Number one, victims aren't just girls and women. Victims can be boys and men, and victims can be people who identify as transgender or outside the binary. Whenever I use the word victim, I hope you're always remembering there's a much larger component than just men and women in doing this. The second thing that we've changed in the last 30, 40 years is the experts now recognize that when attacked, many victims of sexual violence will freeze, right? You have fight, you have flee, and there's the third piece, and that's freeze. And that's often a really smart survival technique. And so not all victims are going to fight back. I didn't when I was 13. When that boy raped me, I just basically shut down, which is very, very common for young teens. So now when we move to a consent-based model of human sexuality, where each partner needs to get consent from the other partner, and that consent has to be sober, informed, ongoing, and enthusiastic. There are some states that have changed their laws to that now, where you have to, it's not, oh, you didn't get no, it's you need to get yes.
Yeah, that's a wonderful distinction. And just consent, you know, consent is the concept that this is all constructed around. I really like that. And what role does toxic masculinity play in this? And I know the answer is fairly obvious on that, but can you discuss toxic masculinity versus healthy, beneficial, empowered masculinity, and what we might see from masculinity versus what we tend to be seeing?
Oh, I really love talking about toxic masculinity because, you know, the thousands and tens of thousands of teenage boys I've talked to over the years have taught me everything I know about it. In addition to their confusion about negotiating healthy sexuality and trying to understand, you know, under shock when they find out that sexual violence can be very traumatizing to the victim, teenage boys have told me how frustrated they are with what they're feeling is the cultural pressure to limit their emotional range. You know, I have six grandsons, and anybody who's raised little boys knows that they are every bit as emotional as girls are, right? We are born in this world with a range of feelings that are lovely and part of being human being. But as they enter the teens, our boys are getting these messages that they're supposed to become dominating figures and they shouldn't show their feelings. Boys are told not to cry. The feelings that they seem to be allowed to show in our culture is anger or rage, preferably on a sports field. And that's very frustrating to the boys I've talked to. They have, you know, tender feelings just as well, as much as girls can be angry or rage-filled. You know, the notion of toxic masculinity, that might be a new concept for some people, but we've been living in it for a long time in our country. It's the notion that rewards and success are based on dominance instead of respect. And I think moving to a respect-based model that acknowledge that everybody has a full range of feelings and permission to feel them and share them is healthier for everyone.
Mm. If you're just joining us, our guest is Laurie Hulse Anderson. Her book is Shout, The True Story of a Survivor Who Refused to Be Silenced. And Laurie, I would say that, in your book Speak, again, published in 1999, that was a young adult fiction. It was a fictional character, but it was based on your own personal experience of rape when you were 13. Is that kind of how it went?
It was based on my emotional truth.
Okay.
At that point, I was not ready to disclose the details of what had happened to me. But like Melinda in Speak, when I was raped, I didn't speak up about it. It took her a year. It took me 23 years. So I use sort of those feelings of you know, responding to the trauma, of feeling lost, of not knowing whom to talk to. I put all those into Speak. I'd say about Speak is about 10% of my story. And then when I started to visit schools again, I realized very quickly that students needed to see a model of survival. And I had a responsibility to them to talk about what I was through personally, but also how I survived it. And those are the stories that I turned into poetry and put into Shout.
Mm. Well, there was a lot of shame and silencing that went on in your family, both from your mother and your father, for various reasons. And I think many of us in, you know, grew up in that, if we're somewhere in our middle age, we grew up with that same sort of thing where you just don't talk about things. But can you describe your family setting?
Oh, I'd love to. You know, and my father was a minister. I grew up in a fairly conservative household, very much New England Yankee sort of stoicism. And I think it's important for all of us who are struggling now as adults to figure out, oh, how are we supposed to talk about these things? To recognize that our parents didn't know how to talk about them, and their parents didn't know how to talk about them. So my parents themselves were raised in a culture of silence. I have a couple of poems about my parents early on in the book to kind of create the setting of my life when I was young so people understand why I didn't just go to my parents when I was attacked. And that silencing is so dangerous to our children. I'm hoping that we can be the generation of parents and grandparents who will, you know, be courageous enough to start talking about these things openly, honestly, and in a healthy way. That's how I believe we can completely change what people call rape culture. If we taught all of our kids about consent, if we gave them permission to come to us when they were hurt instead of shaming them, and if we gave them permission to come to us when they were confused, and then we sought help them seek out the answers, that would be the most responsible parenting this country had ever seen.
So, Lori, all your work over the last couple of decades speaking to kids in high schools and having conversations with their parents and the comments that you're making now about your family and being on the verge of a new age of understanding and holding a space that allows for respect and consent and having the tough conversation, what do you see? Is it happening? Are we on the verge of a new understanding and a new ability to have that conversation?
I have a lot of faith in the generation of people who are under about 35. I think those of us from 35 to 55 or 60, mm-hmm. we're still struggling because we, you know, when I was a young girl, that was when women could be fired for getting pregnant. That was when husbands were allowed to rape wives, and my mother couldn't even explain to me what menstruation was. She just handed me the tampon box, which I'm pretty sure is how she learned about things too. So when I look at the next generation, the upcoming generation, this is a generation that is much more open and loving to people who identify as LGBTQ, and that's just not even a big deal for them. It's just, oh, this is who you are. Well, you're my friend. Let's move on. And so they give me hope. Especially, this is one of the rare instances where social media can be positive. People are finding kindred spirits and like minds to have these conversations. You're seeing a new generation of authors, of filmmakers, of musicians who are willing to kind of push past their parents' limits, if you will, on bravery and explore these topics, always centering respect for each other and love and gentleness in a way that I haven't seen done before.
I'm wondering, do you ever look at what's happening in your area of engagement and research and study and presentations and then broaden it out to what's happening globally and in countries and here in the United States where there seems to be some pushback from the status quo, from traditional definitions of morality and values and family structure, because what you're describing is, you know, accepting everyone for who they are. And that could be very confrontational to some people. And maybe that contributes to the acute sense and the acute reaction that seems to be happening, at least in our country, and the polarization.
There's actually a pushback from a couple of different corners. While I'm very heartened by what I just said, the younger people being more open to each other, at the same time, and pushing back probably at the same pace, very, very sadly, so many of our young boys in America, starting at about age 11 or 12, are learning about sex by watching internet porn.
Yeah.
And that's across the country. That's across cultures. That's across denominations, because it's free and it's available. And few parents of an 11-year-old boy are going to think, oh, my son. But I've heard from emergency room doctors who've treated victims, these boys, when they become sexually active, if they've only ever seen non-consensual scenes of sex, which is what they're watching a lot on pornography, they often think that's what they're supposed to be doing.
Right.
And then you layer on top of that boys coming from a more conservative mindset, the kind that I grew up with, where parents don't have the language or don't have the model and leadership about how to talk to their sons about these things. And so there's a lot of assuming going on that, oh, my son's a good son. But if you don't know what your son is watching on his phone or with his friends, he walks into the locker room and sees what his friends are watching, you don't know the dangerous ideas that are being, shared in his heart. And so parents, I think especially from conservative communities, have a responsibility to figure out how can we have these conversations with our children. You know what's a really great comparison? Because I know there's a lot of people listening whose stomachs are getting tight. It's like, oh gosh, how do I have that conversation with my kid? Compare it to how much energy and care we put into teaching our children how to drive their car, right? We start, at least in my house, when my kids got to be about 10, 11 years old, I started to point out dangerous traffic situations, like, oh, golly, that left-hand turn, boy, this intersection, that's a dangerous one. And then we spend, you know, countless hours sending them to driving school, sitting in the passenger. We help them learn all of the different aspects to keep them safe when they're driving a car. We owe them at least that much care and conversation about their bodies. Sex is a gift. I think every faith community recognizes that, although the different faith communities have different models and standards for the kind of relationship where that gift is to be explored. But when you recognize that so many of our children are being raised even without the words to describe all of their body parts, because parents can't talk about genitalia, for example, we are really harming our kids because they are lacking critically important information. Let's never forget how many children in America are sexually abused by people that they know, sometimes by relatives, people within their community. And those children honestly don't even understand what's happening to them. And unless their parents have talked about this in a frank and loving and appropriate way for their developmental age, those kids aren't going to know that they should be talking to their parents and get help for somebody who's harming them.
Mm. The book is Shout, the true story of a survivor who refused to be silenced. Is it correct to call it a, sort of a follow-up, maybe, to Speak?
I'm calling it a sister book.
A sister book. There we go.
Yeah.
I know you came to Salt Lake City recently to speak to the Library Association, but we would love to have you come to Park City and talk sometime. So I'm going to work on that.
Oh, that would make me so happy. And if any of those librarians who were at the conference a few weeks ago are listening, thank you, because that was such a delightful experience.
We have a lot of initiatives that would dovetail beautifully with you as a speaker in this community, Lori. So that'd be great. I'm going to support Lynn in that effort.
I appreciate that, my friend. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
My pleasure. Take care.